The governor's been traveling around the country on state business. A freshman Democrat wants to know who's paying for it, and he's frustrated that he's not getting answers.
If there's nothing to hide, then just tell us who's paying to fly you there.
Representative Greg Razor on seeking transparency and progress in Jefferson City, this week on Statehouse Blend, Missouri. From KCUR 89.3, this is Statehouse Blend, Missouri. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll talk with Greg Razor in a moment, but first, in Jefferson City this week, it finally happened. Missouri Governor Eric Greitens had a press conference, an honest-to-God, whatever-you-want-to-ask-me press conference. He hasn't done that since taking office on January 9th, and in honor of Missouri Press Association Day this week, he did it. He made no apologies for the rarity of the event, or for making so many of his announcements on social media or outside the Capitol, as when he presented his budget at a preschool in southern Missouri last month.
Like, for example, going down to Nixon, Missouri to release our budget. This is the people's money, and we think it's important that we're going out and communicating directly with people about how their tax money is being spent.
And while any question was fair game, that didn't always mean there was an answer. Greitens declined to talk about how much particular donors gave to his inaugural celebration or who was paying for his out-of-state travel on private planes. Meanwhile, back in the legislative chambers, the Senate did something it has never done. It passed a bill that would make Missouri the 50th and final state with a statewide plan for monitoring prescriptions. But the version they passed, sponsored by Rob Schaff, the Republican senator who's blocked the legislation the last few sessions, limits doctor access to records in the name of protecting privacy. House Republican Holly Rader says she'll insist on the version she's sponsoring, which is supported by doctors' groups.
When it comes to prescribing safely, so that, you know, they're not giving us something that is going to counteract with something that we're already taking, but then also to be able to spot those signs of addiction early on.
Observers say the result of the competing bills may be yet another year or two as the only state without a database. But it looks like a much smoother ride for legislation that will make it far harder to prove discrimination in a wrongful termination case. The Senate passed a bill along party lines that Republicans like sponsor Gary Romine say will protect businesses.
We've seen people use a discriminatory act to cry wolf, to retaliate against an employer when we really have discrimination activities going on, and they get lost sometimes in the weeds because of all the other what I call frivolous lawsuits taking place.
Much of the debate focused on an amendment that would have included sexual orientation and gender identity among the protected categories for discrimination claims. That amendment was defeated on mostly party lines. The whole bill now goes to the Senate, where Democrats, including Greg Razor, our guest today, say they'll put up a fight. Greg, nice to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Really glad you could join us. And also here is KCUR's news director and my boss, Maria Carter.
Hi, Brian.
Good to see you, Maria. You aren't exactly in the position to that I think, at least stereotypically, we would imagine has the most influence. You're a freshman legislator. You're in the minority party, the extreme minority party in the Missouri House.
Super minority. It was a new term I learned.
The super minority with an emphasis on super.
Right. And good for you for being super. But
yes.
Do you feel like you have influence? Do you feel, is it a daily sort of, I'm not even sure why I'm going to work today. I can't get anything done that I actually want.
You would think that that would be the mindset. And I think it can get to that point after many years. But you know, frankly, I wake up every day and I'm in, thanks to the people of my district, I have the opportunity to be in a position with a megaphone. And I can speak on behalf of people who don't necessarily have their voices heard. I get to sit on the budget committee, which is one place where I can have some influence as far as how the state spends money. I can point out what I've found myself doing is pointing out things that strike me as wrong ways of spending state money or wrong priorities for spending state money. And while I would love to be in the supermajority, absolutely, there's no reason to walk into that building every day hanging my head. It's an honor and a privilege to get to serve and to speak up for the way I think we should shape the state of Missouri.
Well, there are definitely some things you have spoken up about, and we're going to ask you about those today. Let me start by going to my colleague, Maria Carter.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was recently reading about was a letter you sent to Missouri Governor Eric Greitens' chief of staff, wanting to know about who was paying for his flights. He's chosen not to use the state plane for many of his trips. I think he's used it once. You know, why'd you send that letter?
So this is not what I want to be working on in Jefferson City. Let me start by saying that. I don't want to be in a battle with the governor's office. However, this started a few weeks ago. We were in budget, a budget committee hearing, and actually going through the governor's office budget. His chief of staff was testifying on behalf of the governor, and he mentioned that the governor doesn't use the state plane, which then led me to ask, is the governor flying anywhere on official business? And the answer was yes. And so I asked, who's paying to fly him around, if not the taxpayers? The chief of staff didn't have an answer for me and said he did not know how he would get an answer, which seemed like an odd way to answer my question. So I sent a letter, an official request for any flights that the governor had used in his official capacity as governor of the state of Missouri, what plane he was on and who paid for that trip. There is a law that requires the governor to provide that. If on a state-owned plane, there's this little weird loophole that was embedded into the law. And I pointed that out in my letter, that I would hope they wouldn't use that loophole to shield who they have paying for these trips. And in fact, that's exactly what they did. They responded in letter yesterday, telling me that they intend to use that loophole to not tell me who's paying to fly him around the country.
Maybe you shouldn't have pointed it out.
I'm pretty, their deputy chief of staff wrote the law, and so I'm pretty sure he realized that was there.
Yeah.
I guess I think the governor's office has said that to the degree that any of those flights might be regarded as donations, those would get reported at some later point through the Missouri Ethics Commission.
Well, right? From my understanding, if those trips were campaign-related trips for Greitens for Missouri, then at some point he has to report that to the Missouri Ethics Commission as a campaign expense. Let's say he and the First Lady were flying to D.C. to go visit a friend's wedding or something, and someone provided that. He would have to report that on his personal financial disclosure as a gift personally. However, it's really a gift to the taxpayers of Missouri that, you know, they weren't flying Eric Greitens. They were flying the office of governor. Well, who is paying to fly the office of governor around, and why are they paying?
So would an example of a trip like this be his visit to the White House recently?
Yeah, I believe he has flown to, if I'm not mistaken, he has flown to Washington twice, once last week when he met with the Governor's Association and had lunch with the president. He has also met with Vice President Pence once or twice. You know, if there's nothing to hide, then just tell us who's paying to fly you there. And why aren't you using the plane the taxpayers provide for you?
You know, it's interesting to me that you said you didn't want to be the guy who was known for going after the governor on his travel. Do you feel like other people should be asking the question? Are you surprised that you're the one who is asking these questions?
I mean, I don't know. I feel like there are probably some within the governor's own party who the question crossed their mind, but, you know, they don't want to be the one to call out the governor. And it just so happened that I sit on the committee where this information came out, and I'm the one that raised my hand. So that's how I've gotten in this position. I'd much rather be talking about how are we going to fully fund education and higher education and build new roads and bridges and move the state forward. Instead, we're trying to see, is the governor trying to hide something from us?
Are you surprised that there aren't, maybe you're not surprised about other Republicans asking, but are you surprised that other Democrats aren't asking?
No, because there are other Democrats asking other questions. For example, a colleague of mine has been asking about who has paid for the governor's inaugural ball, which is something that he hasn't disclosed. He hasn't disclosed who paid for his PAC, which donated, I think, almost $2 million to his campaign. We still don't know who that donor was. So there are people asking multiple questions about why isn't he disclosing what everyone else discloses. Yeah. And this just happens to be the one that I'm asking about.
Imagine we have not heard the last about that. That came up in Governor Greitens' press conference yesterday,
yes.
or the day before yesterday, which was actually the first sort of open press conference he's had where reporters could ask anything they wanted to. So,
in 2 months.
I want to ask you about something you just mentioned a moment ago, which was roads and bridges, the things you would rather be talking mm-hmm. about. Infrastructure in Missouri is something that in your short time in the legislature, you have already made a number of statements about,
yes.
and the need for a different way of handling the state's transportation infrastructure. A lot of Kansas City legislators bring that up with us as something that needs to change. What do you want to see happen? What should be different and what can be different?
So it's a fascinating issue. So our infrastructure in Missouri is literally crumbling. If you drive down I-70 or you drive on a rural lettered route, the surface looks relatively good, but just below the surface, the foundation is crumbling. That's true of our roads, our bridges, our ports, our whole infrastructure system. We need to come up with a way of refunding MoDOT. MoDOT is to the point now where they have enough money to kind of hold the system together, but not enough money to move us forward as a state. This after they have laid off 1,200 employees, closed offices, sold off equipment, et cetera, et cetera. The problem we have is there are essentially, from what I can tell, there are three reasonable ways of funding MoDOT, each of which has huge problems. So there's increasing the gas tax, there's toll roads, or sales tax, dedicated sales tax, which the voters have already voted down, each of which have serious problems, but one of them has to happen. The problem is anyone who, and this is especially true for the majority party in Jefferson City, whoever raises their hand with the idea that says this is how we're going to move forward will be attacked in their next election for proposing the largest tax increase in the state of Missouri history. And no one in the majority party is willing to take that risk and take that hit. And so we're left with a crumbling infrastructure.
So what can happen then? You're complaining about it. Is there a way forward?
I think what is going to have to happen, I believe what we need is to have a group of, I don't know if it's a coalition of Missouri business and labor and safety experts to come out and begin to educate the public on the seriousness of where we are on this issue, to give legislators the backing they need to pass this project, to propose it and pass it and move the state forward. Like I said, when you drive down the roads, they look pretty good. For the most part.
It's a news story this week, though, that says, for example, the Buck O'Neill Bridge, the formerly the Broadway Bridge in Kansas City, mm-hmm. might have to come out and be closed for 2 years,
yes.
Starting in 2019. Those kinds of projects.
I think you could go to
horizon.
Any county in Missouri. I think there have been multiple studies out there about the number of crumbling bridges. And, you know, there's probably a safety concern and multiple ones in every single district.
I spent 8 years working in rural Missouri and particularly rural Northwest Missouri, and I don't know if there was ever a meeting where I didn't hear from civic leaders, governmental leaders, or the public in those meetings of, what about route so-and-so? What about the such-and-such bridge? When are we going to do something to fix these? And my response back to them is start sending people to Jefferson City who are willing to do it.
But isn't that the other point and maybe the other side of this ledger sheet? Yes, you could raise taxes somehow to bring in a lot more revenue. You could also look at how much expenditures there are for transportation in the state. A point that Senator Ryan Silvey has made on this podcast is that we have a disproportionate number of state-funded miles of
yes.
road in Missouri. Can you imagine a day where there are fewer state highways in Missouri? You laugh.
I have heard Senator Silvey's proposal, and I understand it. So it was decades ago that the state of Missouri bought what at the time would have been county highways to set up this mammoth system within the state, which is now our lettered route. So if you're out in rural Missouri and you come across Route ZZ, that used to be a county road, which now we own. The problem is I can tell you the county commissioners will lose their minds if you propose this. Because then what happens if you are a small rural county, the county commissioners have to raise taxes somehow to figure out how to maintain those roads. And those county commissioners don't want to raise taxes, and the state legislature doesn't want to raise taxes. And if anybody in Washington proposes raising taxes, they get stones thrown at them. Someone has to pay for the roads.
It's another rural-urban divide in the state, right?
It shouldn't be a rural-urban divide. The roads in rural Missouri, agriculture is one of our largest industries, and the farmers have to get crops from the field to where they're selling it. Yeah. And their kids have to get to school, and the ambulance has to go down the road. And if that bridge falls out because we don't have money, now you've just added 5, 10, 15 miles to each one of those trips. It's hurting the school districts. It's hurting public safety. It's hurting business. The same thing that happens if you close the Broadway Bridge or the Buck O'Neill Bridge for 2 years. I mean, it's a larger scale, but again, someone has to pay for these roads if we want the roads. Maybe we decide we don't want the roads anymore.
Which is, I suppose, a possibility, but it seems unlikely to come out of the General Assembly.
Yes.
What else is on your mind, Maria?
Well, I think, you know, what's in the news today in Kansas City is a minimum wage bill in the legislature that's been proposed that would limit the ability of cities to enact a higher minimum wage. And, you know, we won't go into the whole history of all that, but, you know, what are your thoughts on that and, you know, kind of the state taking a stand as, you know, cities are looking to perhaps do their own thing that they deem is best for their residents?
You know, I think this is an issue that if a city, if whether it's St. Louis, Kansas City, Columbia, whoever, wants to pass an ordinance raising the minimum wage, if they want to, I know the city of Columbia had said you had to be 21 to buy cigarettes or ban plastic bags, they should be allowed to do it. There is this fascinating theory amongst the kind of the far right, and I've seen it so often in my short time in Jefferson City, that they call it federalism, that the state governments are in charge of everything, that the federal government is subservient to the states because we created the federal government, and the local governments have to listen to the states because we created them. Therefore, everything derives from Jefferson City. I would disagree with that. I think we have court decisions proving the opposite, and we fought a war about it in the 1860s that kind of settled that issue. But it goes back to that theory.
Yeah. I mean, as a person who grew up in rural Missouri in the Ozarks, and, you know, and I wasn't going to – I was guessing by your accent.
Yes.
There. you know, I mean, to me, the minimum wage – I mean, you're not going to live richly and even in the Ozarks on that at the state level, but you're going to get by perhaps a little bit better than in some more urban areas where you're paying a lot more for housing and some of the, you know, other things in life. You know, it seems like there are cost differentials between living in different places.
Absolutely. And you know, I think you go back, we're talking about people, let's say it's somebody that's working 40 hours a week. And if you're working 40 hours a week, you should be paid enough that you can get by without government assistance.
Yeah.
You know, if you're working 40 hours a week, you shouldn't need Medicaid. You shouldn't need food stamps as well. That's the government subsidizing these private companies if that's the way we do it. And for many large companies that are big employers in rural Missouri, that is the way we do it. Their employees are on government assistance. And to move that even farther, something I didn't realize, 14% of all full-time MoDOT employees are eligible for public assistance,
wow,
Medicaid or food stamps. Our own state employees.
Wow. So, what do you do about it? Because another option would be to raise the statewide minimum wage to a higher level. That might be satisfactory to the cities, but that's not going to happen either.
That's no. What we do about it is get people in Jefferson City that are ready to be serious about putting our heads together to figure out what to do about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the solution.
That seems to be the solution to a lot of things.
Yes.
and what's preventing that? I mean, I know, again, you're new at this, at least mm-hmm. in this particular role, but mm-hmm. but do you see that changing? Is the culture of Jeff City that has, as you see it at least, allowed people not to put their heads together and not get solutions to these, what I think you regard as fairly obvious problems, how does that change? Does that culture just get handed down to your fellow freshman class so that 5 years from now a new legislator is coming in and they say, oh, that Razor and his bunch, they're never going to change?
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with obviously us in the legislature, but also the mood of Missourians. I think whether it's in Missouri state politics, national politics, politics is a pendulum, and it moves from right to left. And right now we are in a move to the right. I don't see how we can get much farther right than we are right now, which means that the movement is starting to go back to the left. We see that in Kansas, where Kansas had moved as far right as they possibly could. Now there are, I think, a handful more Democrats and some moderate Republicans moving that pendulum, not to the left, but back towards the middle. And I think eventually you'll see that in Missouri.
Who would have thought you'd hear a Missouri legislator looking to Kansas for inspiration? A Missouri Democrat.
A Missouri Democrat, and I'm ashamed to say it.
Yes. And upside down.
Yes.
Well, I mean, and on that note, there's another piece of legislation that's moved forward this week over on the Senate side that would change employment discrimination law. Mm-hmm. So now, if this bill becomes law, it's on its way over to you in the House. To win a case, an employee to show bias would have to show that bias was a motivating factor and not just a contributing factor, meaning it's going to be harder to sue for wrongful termination, that you'd have to show that bias is the reason someone was fired as opposed to just a factor in it, basically. Are you going to be supporting this when it comes over to the House?
No, and I'm not an attorney, but from what I understand, it doesn't just make it harder, it makes it nearly impossible to prove that, you know, discrimination was the motivating factor of firing. I think an employer could say, well, there was that day you were 5 minutes late, and that's why you were fired. And can you prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that that wasn't the reason? Mm-hmm. It makes it nearly impossible, and it really hurts our non-discrimination laws in the state of Missouri.
Indications are that it will have a fair amount of support in the House.
I'm sure it will. Most of what we've done in the State House this year has been geared towards helping the interest of business, and from my perspective, at the expense of workers and the average Missourian.
I was just wondering, you know, this is, you know, just talking about that one word, you were mentioning so many things coming before you. And I could see reading this bill as the first time, you know, I mean, this is changing some current language, but, you know, you're reading something, you know, if this was something newly enacted and you're like, oh, motivating factor. Yeah, that sounds right. You know, sometimes it's amazing to me how this really comes down to, you know, one word or one technical phrase that may even not be quite how in everyday life that you would understand something.
Absolutely. And I think this is probably one of them, one of the examples of where I turned to my colleagues and that was an attorney and said, explain this one a little bit more to me, which he did. So, I mean, we're changing it from, you know, my boss was a racist or a sexist or mm-hmm. for whatever reason. And that is one of the reasons that he or she finally fired me and you can sue, to this is the only reason.
Well,
we got
in
fired.
Fact, a motivating reason. This, in fact, was the compromise, right? There was a filibuster
yeah.
that the original language was the sole reason, the only reason.
Wow.
So this is what passes for compromise in the Missouri
Senate. But I don't know how you prove motivating. Anyway, that's the
right.
argument.
Yeah. One of the actually the longer debate over this bill was on an amendment to the bill that would have added sexual orientation as one of the protected mm-hmm. classes. That amendment was defeated. Also, not passing apparently this year as the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act. You're the co-sponsor along with Randy Dunn of this bill in the House. This is the 19th year in a row the Missouri Non-Discrimination Act has been introduced in both the House and the Senate. probably won't pass, it would seem. I guess I want to ask you about the state of LGBTQ issues and legislation in Missouri. You're now one of a handful of openly gay legislators. What's the horizon look like? What's the situation from your perspective?
The fascinating part is many years ago I advocated in Jefferson City on behalf of this very bill that I now have the honor of introducing. And back then, I think we had one or two Republicans that co-sponsored, but we really focused on trying to get Democratic co-sponsors, and you know they were near the majority at that time. And what I would hear, the inner city Democrats jumped right on board to co-sponsor. Rural Democrats ran from it, and Democrats in suburban communities would give me the example of, Greg, if it ever comes to the floor, we'll vote with you, but we can't put ourselves out on that limb as far as to co-sponsor it. As I go and talk to a lot of my Republican colleagues now, some 15 years later, there are no inner city Republicans, but from what I'm hearing is a lot of suburban Republicans saying quietly, Greg, if this comes to the floor, we're probably with you, but we can't put ourselves out on the limb. It's interesting to see this mirror effect of where my Republican colleagues are now, who are good-hearted and I'm not bigoted on this issue at all, but where they are politically on this issue to where Democrats were nearly 15 years ago, if that makes sense.
Yes, it makes sense. I'm mindful of the fact that the one time this did pass in the Missouri Senate back in 2013 was when Senator Joli Justice, and she's talked a lot about this, sort of reached across the aisle to Republicans, and because of the relationship they had, mm-hmm. it was able to pass. She attributes it to those relationships and that hard work. You're now one of a handful, as I said, of gay legislators. Is that part of what is going to ultimately change how this goes in the legislature, or is that not going to be enough?
It's absolutely part of it. I think there is a difference between being a member of the much smaller Senate and being one of 163 in the House, but the principle still holds the same. There are three openly gay members of the Missouri State House, two on the Democratic side and actually one on the Republican side now. And we do have to build those relationships, particularly with the members of the Republican Party who generally you wouldn't think support us. So the more rural, those who are a little older, who just when you by reflex you think, oh, that person's not going to support us. Well, that's not necessarily true. I actually had a rural Republican approach me in the hall and said, can we get together and talk about this? That person is not ready to co-sponsor it, but wanted to learn more. And those kind of things are encouraging. And it's someone who I'd built a relationship with over the past couple of months. And so over the years, as we build those relationships, hopefully we can see movement on this again.
Well, and it seems, I mean, to me, so much attitudes in rural areas, I mean, they may not have shifted as much, but they are shifting. You know, when the Supreme Court ruling about same-sex marriage came down, it was surprising to me. Some people who in high school that I'm friends with on Facebook, you know, were supportive of it and, you know, and that I would not have imagined to be. I got a real sense that, you know, like in my almost 20 years since high school now, that things in that community are changing, you know, much like the broader culture has changed in that time.
You know, you said you grew up in the Ozarks.
Yeah.
I grew up in Southeast Missouri on a farm in the Boot Hill, and things are much different today. I've had, you know, friends of mine from high school that have reached out to me later in life and apologized. You know, Greg, we didn't realize what you were going through then. Once it was even, my kid is now gay, and I'm sorry because I see what he's going through, and it made me think about what you must have been going through. And that's really powerful. It's part of that bigger argument within the LGBT community that the more we come out, the more it moves our civil rights forward, because it's hard to say no once you know someone who is gay or lesbian, transgender. And so I think we're seeing that There's very few people left in this country that can say they aren't friends or have a loved one who is a member of the LGBT community.
Have you ever encountered in the legislature discrimination or any different kind of treatment because you are gay? You know, there's been reporting over the years that women have felt like they've been treated in a sexist way in the halls of the state capitol in Jeff City. Have you felt any of that personally?
I haven't. I think a strong argument could be made that it is harder to be a female legislator in Jefferson City than it is to be an openly gay legislator in Jefferson City. I think it is harder to go to Jefferson City and advocate on women's health issues than it is to go and advocate on LGBT issues. When I was there years ago, that wasn't the case. It was the other way around. I think those attitudes have flipped.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't have a good answer. But I do oftentimes feel like my female colleagues probably have it a tougher time than I do. I had a Republican approach me in the parking garage. This was maybe 2 weeks ago, and said, "Hey, Greg, I just wanted to let you know I had no idea you were gay. Just want you to know that mattered to me. You know, we don't ever vote the same, but I like you. You're a good guy. I just want you to know that I know, and I'm cool with it." There's some of those really interesting moments that happen.
And do you take that as an affirming conversation? Are you glad for those kind of conversations, or do they make you shake your head and say, "Huh, that's a weird thing to have to say"?
No, I think it would be weird if it was another inner city liberal. But knowing where the person was coming from, I think that was a big step forward. And that person did it out of being aware and caring and wanting to build a relationship. And I was very pleased that he did it.
Yeah. Do you think, just almost wondering if it's almost like one of those things, that person might have been worried that you'd make assumptions if he was a rural Republican or, you know, et cetera, that, you know, he wasn't okay with it.
And I'm probably a little ashamed to say that I do make that assumption. I think we all have built-in assumptions that we make. And there are probably members that I shouldn't make that assumption about.
Yeah.
And I think all of us are guilty of that to some degree.
It's tough being human.
Yes, yes.
And speaking of being human, I do want to disclose for our listeners, my work at KCUR is part-time. The other part of my time, I'm executive director of a nonprofit that does advocacy work on LGBT issues, mostly in a religious context, but we try to be objective about this and on everything else, but I wanted you, our listeners, to know that in full disclosure. Greg Razor, I want to ask you one more thing. You made reference earlier to the fact that you were on the budget committee.
Mm-hmm.
When we had House Majority Leader Mike Searpoint here a couple of weeks ago, he talked about those guys, those poor souls on the budget committee who he sees walking out of the room late at night looking like zombies, their eyes crossed from staring at all those numbers. You are looking at a pretty tough budget right now. The governor's proposal for that budget includes hundreds of millions of dollars of cuts from programs that are beloved, from education to social services. What's that experience like for you right now? How's it going?
So there are two worlds in the state capitol. There are those of us who are on the budget and our eyes are crossed and you can see the bags under my eyes right now. And then there's everything else that's going on. And I don't think I fully appreciated that when I asked to be on budget. But here I am. It's fascinating to see the process. It's fascinating to see where our tax dollars go and where they end up. And sometimes it's very frustrating to see what we prioritize. So we're in a tough budget year, and it's a self-induced problem from several years ago with budget, with corporate tax cuts. The fact is now, though, we have about $450 million that we have to cut. And if you walk around Jefferson City, what you're going to hear over and over is, it's a tough year, everyone has to cinch up their belts. Well, that's not what we're actually asking people to do. It's a tough year, and social services and higher education have to cinch up their belts. Everyone else is getting a free pass. Everyone else, are coming into us and saying, we're just asking for what we got last year. And it appears that for the most part, there's obviously going to be a handful of exceptions, but for the most part, we're checking that off. That will be fine. But higher education is taking, I believe, a 10% across the board cut. The University of Missouri, because of some specific line items, if you include that, they're taking more like a 14% cut to their state budget this year. That's huge for the university system. It's huge for UMKC, Mizzou.
Which is in your district, UMKC.
It borders my district, okay, but I'll claim it.
Sure.
All right. I'll claim
and
it.
And which, in all fairness, employs us.
Yes.
We are
yes.
a part of UMKC.
For our license.
Absolutely. And we're seeing it in social services. So it's very hard for me. I have a hard time justifying some of the non-cutbacks that we're making when I have to look people with severe disabilities in the eye and tell them, we may not have the money to allow you to have in-home health care anymore. We may force you into a nursing home because we had to give a corporation a tax break. That's very hard. We had a group of, they made an impact on me. We had a group of Kansas Cityans who came to Jefferson City. They were all seniors, and they take care of their spouse who has Alzheimer's. And there is a sliver of a program that provides things that Medicaid or Medicare wouldn't pay for to help them get through life. And we're making cuts to that program. And I have to sit and look them in the eye and try to explain how that is. And I can't do it. I can't justify it.
So I'm hearing that you aren't completely happy with the governor's proposed budget. Do you have a better solution? What would you cut instead of these deep cuts to those social services and to higher education?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't have passed huge tax cuts years ago. We should have taken Medicaid expansion, which would have solved a lot of these problems from the Affordable Care Act. There are lots of things we shouldn't have done to get there. That being said, we look at an issue. I remember the other day we were sitting, and I'll give you an example to answer your question. We're sitting, and within about a 10-minute period, we looked at a $500,000 line item that went to a nonprofit in Cape Girardeau that helped, say, like 18 to 21-year-old young people with autism learn job skills so they could go out and work on their lives. We cut $300,000 out of that $500,000 budget. And the sense was, we'll pat ourselves on the back because here we found $300,000. Within 10 minutes, there was a $16 million line item. This line item was entitled the Community College Retraining Program, something, something. As questions kept rolling in about this, it dawned on me, and I asked the question, I said, is this money going to community colleges? And the answer was no. I said, is this money going to companies to retrain their employees? And the answer was yes. And I said, is this going to small companies that can't afford to retrain their employees in order to grow, and that's why we're investing? The answer was no. So I asked, give me an example of a company that may take this money. And the answer was Boeing. Now, I am all for making Boeing happy. They're a large employer in our state. They're important to the St. Louis economy. And I'm all for them retraining their employees. But we're saying everyone has to cinch their belts. And here was a line item in the budget that had no cinching. Yet we cut over half of this money to help autistic kids in Southeast Missouri. And again, that it was very frustrating.
You said the budget committee is a place where you can have some influence, mm-hmm. even as a member of the minority party. Mm-hmm. What can you do?
Well, as we are going through line items in the budget, I can make amendments, and we're going to start that process in a couple of weeks. I'm learning a lot this year about how the budget process works. But we can make an amendments and try to move money from one program to another. And those are things I'm looking at now of where I may try to look. And of course, we have to have a balanced budget. So anything that I try to add to one part of the budget, I have to take from another as kind of the rule that we use in budget. And so you each of us on that committee have to find what project we want to try to help. And then you have to go and try to find a place to take it. And all of these all of these line items have very valid needs. The problem is we don't have enough money anymore. And so you have to take it from something that is also going to be hurt to give it to something else. And so that's what I'm looking at right now.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yes.
Maria Carter, anything else from you today?
No, I'm all questioned out.
All right. State Representative Greg Razor, Democrat of Kansas City, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you, Maria Carter.
Thanks, Brian.
Statehouse Blend Missouri is produced by Matt Hodapp. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you like what you hear, post a review there. We'd appreciate it. You can also find us on the NPR One app. Just search for us in Explore and then tap Follow. We're also on Twitter. I'm at PTS Brian. You can hear my good friend and colleague over there on the Kansas side, Sam Zeff. He's at Sam Zeff. We try to use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of us on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR. If you have any other thoughts on the program, shoot me an email. I'm at brian@kcur.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you around.